From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is being made as we speak in Albany, where the state legislature is finalizing the budget deal. And yes, it includes a significant increase in the minimum wage for New York City and Long Island, another increase for upstate that is different. It also includes a paid family leave program, and it eliminates the so-called GEA, that's the Gap Elimination Adjustment, related to school funding. What does it all mean? Well, we're going to try to sort it all out as best we can from what we do know right now. And we have a lot to talk about this hour. In studio with me is Eamon Scanlon, the lead education organizer with both Metro Justice and the Alliance for Quality Education. Eamon, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much, Evan.
And Eamon's going to be able to talk about their views on what happened when it comes to education funding. He'll also be able to weigh in on minimum wage and other issues. And on the line with us to help sort some of this out is the Capitol Bureau Chief for WXXI News. It's Karen DeWitt. Karen, did you sleep at all?
Yes, I got my 6 hours of sleep. So I'm doing a lot better than a lot of people here at the Capitol
yes.
today, as the Assembly is still having conference meetings and will be voting well into the afternoon to finish up the budget.
Okay, so we think we see the basic framework, though,
yes.
and unless there are any last-minute changes or any last-minute drama, which...
Well, I should point out the Senate did finish. They stayed up all night. So unless the Assembly were to walk away from something, which is very unlikely, it's pretty much finished now.
Now, we can't hit every part of the budget deal that we've seen from the Senate, but I'll do my best to kind of walk through four big prongs with Karen DeWitt here. And the one where there's nothing is an ethics deal. No ethics deal, right, Karen?
Yes, that one won't take very much time to discuss, I guess, despite the fact that Governor Cuomo put it in his budget to make some changes like banning or limiting outside income to close some campaign finance loopholes. The legislature didn't even consider that. Critics say Governor Cuomo didn't push very hard for it. The governor says he wants to have it by the end of the session, though, so he is going to try again.
All right, on the minimum wage, what I want to do is read the schedule that I saw this morning, and you can tell me if this is correct or if we can expect any changes.
Good idea.
Here's the deal that I'm seeing. New York State will New York City and Long Island and Westchester County will have a $15 minimum wage in 3 years, and small businesses there will have 4 years to get to a $15 minimum wage. Upstate New York, which is everything outside of New York City, Westchester, and Long Island, upstate New York with a $12.50 minimum wage by the year 2021. So in 5 years, we'll be at $12.50. And if you adjust for inflation, we're probably going to be around $11 an hour, maybe just a little bit more, by 2021. Karen, is that correct?
Well, the only difference is that it's going to be a 6-year phase into $15 an hour for Long Island
okay.
and Westchester.
Okay. So, and then I'm reading, Karen, something I confess I don't fully understand. $12.50 for upstate, then indexed to 15. I understand indexing, but how do you index to 15 when the wage is $12.50?
Yeah, nobody really understands that part of it. There's going to be a pause in 2019 to study the economic effects of raising the minimum wage up to whatever point it gets to by then, and that's going to be done by the governor's own people, his division of budget. So it's surmised that they will say everything's fine and now we can index it to $15 an hour. That's the belief certainly among opponents, the small business groups. They say, you know, that pause doesn't mean anything because Governor Cuomo controls the outcome, and we know that they're going to say it's going to go up to 15. But certainly on the other side, a lot of supporters are disappointed because upstate, it's only going to be $12.50, while downstate, it's $15, and they wanted $15 for the whole state. And they point out that, sadly, in the upstate economy, a lot of people, a minimum wage job is your career for your adult life. So they feel like it needs to be, you know, government needs to step in and ensure that these people make a living wage, so because they're not going to get a better job at some point in the future, is the thinking.
Now, Karen, if it's Governor Astorino in 2019, you know, or a Republican, could we then see some movement to block the increase based on whatever review takes place?
Well, Governor Cuomo assured us in a briefing last night that he's going to be governor in 2019.
He did? Okay.
I guess he's going to run for re-election, which we know, and he thinks he's going to win. But you're right. A lot of this is out in the future, and no worker should think, I'm going to get $15, you know, starting tomorrow that they pass the budget. Like many, many other things in the budget, it's phased in over a multi-year period. And you're right. Who knows if Wall Street, the stock market crashes again? Everything could change.
12.50 right now. If you figure in 2021, the best guess is it'd be around $11 an hour based on inflation. So it's not nothing, but when we say 12.50, the context is needed. Just as $15 an hour in 2021 would be around $13.30 an hour. So again, certainly not nothing. It's just a matter of when we talk in today's dollars, doesn't always perfectly equate. Okay. So, but Karen, fair to say that that's what we expect the assembly to get on board with this afternoon, yes?
Yes.
Okay. Just some notes from the Senate, by the way. Flanagan, the Republican majority leader in the Senate, said, quote, I think we took care of working men and women across the state. And Rich Funke put out a statement today. Here's what he had to say on the minimum wage. Quote, we fought and defeated the governor's minimum wage proposal, delivering a common sense solution that shields local employers from $15 an hour while providing a fair wage for a fair day's work that reflects the true cost of living in our area. But Bill Nojay, a Republican assemblyman who will be voting this afternoon, put out a statement saying, and has been saying on Twitter, that that wage represents the governor's war on upstate New York, even at 12.50 an hour.
What I know of Mr. Nojay, I think we could safely say he'll be voting no on
yes.
this later this afternoon.
Yes, indeed. So that's where the wage is. On paid family leave, $1 per week deducted from workers' paychecks starting in 2018, offering 12 weeks of paid family leave. You have to be employed for 6 months before being eligible, and this would make New York State essentially the most generous paid family leave program of the four states. That will be the fourth state that does it in the country. Is that correct?
Yeah, and I don't believe that you get full pay. I think it will be up to two-thirds when it's fully phased in. So I guess you could call that a partial paid family leave. And again, for people who think, oh, good, I'm going to finally get the time off to take care of my child or a sick parent. No, you're not going to get it for 2 or 3 years or more. It's going to take several years. So, they're kind of taking credit for this program. It's going to be the greatest in the nation, but it won't even start for 2.5 years.
Okay. It's 2018 for paid family leave.
Yes.
The gap elimination adjustment is gone, and this is the alphabet soup of school funding. But
I'm so glad that you have Eamon on for this part of it. the school stuff all happened overnight, and it's a bit confusing.
Okay. So let me just ask Eamon what you understand, and then we'll let kind of Karen weigh in as well here. The gap elimination... The GEA, the Gap Elimination Adjustment, remind our listeners, because I know that can lull some people to sleep, but this is important. What was it?
So the Gap Elimination Adjustment was created in the depths of the recession to fill leaky budget holes that the state legislature did not know how to. And so they decided to rob education of hundreds of millions of dollars. Now they have finally closed their self-imposed problem. But the issue is that money is going to mainly help average needs districts. So if you look at Rochester, the total funding is more or less minuscule. It's like $100,000 total for the entire district and the 28,000 students that go there. It won't make a significant difference for any of the high needs districts throughout the entire state. It will be beneficial to average needs and districts with low needs. But the districts that actually need the money, you know, they're being left behind because of the foundation aid increase. And to parse these two things out, we have the gap elimination adjustment. That's money that was just taken out to fill gaps in the budget. Then you have the campaign for fiscal equity. And that was a court case that started in New York City that said that students do not have a sound basic education. They're not getting access to that. And they won that court case, which... the result was a new foundation aid formula, which was billions of dollars set aside, and a formula that targets high needs districts. And what the assembly proposed, which would have really helped get us closer to that goal of a sound basic education for every New Yorker, was $2.1 billion.
Go ahead, Karen.
I would just add that court order was in 2006.
Yes.
Right? And it has actually never been fulfilled. So according to the court, New York is still in violation of the state's constitution and not providing, as it says in the constitution, sound basic education for each child.
That's exactly right. They still owe $4.4 billion in CFE money. And this, I believe it's about a $600 million increase in foundation aid gets us nowhere close to that. You could go another 7 years at that rate of increase to actually try to close that gap. So it's woefully inadequate in terms of the overall funding for high needs districts. There are still districts across the state that will have to cut funding as a result of this increase. A lot of people hear there's an increase in money, they should be happy. Well, operating costs go up every year. It's not that simple. And it really does nothing to address the still persistent racial and economic inequalities we have throughout this state.
You also have the effects of a property tax cap, too, that because of where inflation is, it's going to be just about 0% that schools are allowed to raise their taxes this year. And those school budget votes are coming up in just about another month.
Yeah, and as Karen said, the property tax cap, and again, Eamon and Karen, correct me if I'm wrong, now, if you are a school district that wants to exceed the increase of the property tax cap, you need a supermajority of voters, a 60% threshold. We saw, for example, West Irondequoit try to do that, I think, 2 years ago. Is it 2014, I think? And they got 56 and 54%. Brighton was able to overcome that supermajority. So, but you don't see a lot of districts even try that. So they essentially stay with the cap. And a lot of people think the cap's around 2%, but sometimes it's significantly less than
2% or the rate of inflation,
which
I think at the time people thought inflation would keep going up, and it hasn't. So that's why it's like 0.12% is all they're allowed to increase.
Yeah. That's the problem, because the governor will say 2%. We have this 2% cap, and a lot of people think there's more flexibility there, but it's essentially zero. It hovers around 0.1. I think at one point it was like 0.06%. It's nothing.
Okay. And so, Karen, before we let you go, this afternoon the Assembly votes, and to be clear, this budget does look like a done deal. I mean, I saw some of your colleagues on Twitter saying they'll meet, they'll go through the deliberations, but the three men in a room got this done, and it is essentially done.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. It's just that they wanted to discuss it a little bit more, and they just, I don't know, maybe they don't have the stamina the Senate has. They didn't want to stay up all night.
Anything else that we did not mention that's in this budget that should be a headline, Karen?
No SUNY tuition increase, mm-hmm. which should make a lot of parents happy, but SUNY's lost the authority to raise tuition if they may have to in the future.
Okay. Karen, thanks for the great reporting. I know we'll look for more of your work this afternoon on WXXI News, and thanks for the time.
All right. Thank you.
Karen DeWitt's the Capital Bureau Chief for WXXI News, joining us from Albany. And so for the remainder of the hour, we're going to work through some of these issues and talk a little bit more about possible impacts here. Eamon Scanlon is with me in studio. He's the lead education organizer with Metro Justice and the Alliance for Quality Education. And later this hour, we'll have some other guests joining us by phone who maybe take a different tack on things like minimum wage. So, but let's stay for a minute with education here, because I want to read, I'll go back to Senator Rich Funke's statement, which he touched on a number of issues. I read his comments on minimum wage. Here's what Senator Funke said on education in the budget that is passing today. Quote, "The gap elimination adjustment is history, and local schools will receive the full funding they need to get every student job ready by graduation. In fact, the more than $24 billion in education aid included in this budget represents the largest investment ever in our schools." End quote. So I don't want to speak for the senator, but I think you can infer, Eamon, that he would disagree with your take that this is woefully inadequate, that we are already spending a lot per pupil, and that we have now given schools the tools to at least maintain and to improve upon what they're doing.
It's easy from a certain vantage point to think that schools are getting the funding they need when you ignore the high poverty, high needs districts like Rochester and the rest of the Big Five. And that's what Funke is not looking at. And that's what he is failing to meet is the obligation of the Campaign for Fiscal Equity and the $4.4 billion in outstanding funding that those schools and high needs districts need. I would like to, though, hold up. There was some positive things. You know, we fought really hard for $200 million for community schools. And for those who don't know what a community school is, it's really a hub within a community that has a lot of extra programs, not just for the students. You do have enriching after school, but you have things like health clinics and career services, lots of things that fulfill the needs of everybody within that community. And it leads to a higher sense of parent engagement. In fact, parent engagement is a requisite to have a strong and thriving community school. And right now, under the receivership law, we would rather than see these schools punished and threatened with being closed down, we want them to be converted to community schools. And the $175 million set aside in the budget for that will get us a lot of the way there. I know working with parents at School 44, School 17, School 9, you know, a lot of the receivership schools here in Rochester, they're clamoring for these programs. And having the funding to start to build some of that success is a real positive and one of the real bright spots in this budget.
All right, so this budget will provide some of that funding that you need for that. And you mentioned how the money can be used. How quickly can you put it to use? And give me again some more specifics on where it might be used and how.
So it'll be used in the schools that were designated as struggling and persistently struggling. So there's 144 schools statewide. There are 14 here in Rochester. I named a few earlier. And it can be put to use right away in creating a lot of those more enriching programs that we don't always see in the city. A lot more of the arts and music and after-school activities and things for parents, because right now you have really high-needs parents in addition to students. So if they can get career training, if they can get medical services on site, it just draws them closer. And the schools are open longer. If you put money in where people can be there, the community can come in and hold events there and really get tied to the school. Because I know here in Rochester, we have a problem where less than about 20% of kids are often enrolled in the school that is closest to them in this district. So creating that sense of community goes a long way, and it's been proven in study after study that it increases parent engagement, it increases achievement, and it would do a lot for the kids and the rest of the community here in Rochester.
Before we start taking your phone calls, if you want to weigh in on minimum wage, education funding, paid family leave, whatever it was, with questions or comments about what's coming down today in the state budget, you can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. From your perspective, as the lead education organizer with Metro Justice and the Alliance for Quality Education, was that funding for community schools, was that the biggest victory in this budget?
By far. I mean, I would say that I don't want to diminish the victories for paid family leave and the victories for $15 an hour for those who do live downstate. That is huge, and that is a game changer. But when it comes to just education purely, I think the commitment to community schools is the one thing that really could serve and help this community. And eventually all schools could be community schools. And if we had that investment across the board, not just the money set aside for the struggling schools, but if we really invested in every school in Rochester and across the state that's in a high needs district, I think we would see the real changes that we're always so loudly clamoring for.
And when it comes to the gap elimination adjustment, forgive the host for not knowing every details and the mechanism of how it works, but you're indicating that it is a bigger boon for suburban schools than it is even for city schools. Is that right?
Yeah, suburban schools, not even necessarily, you know, rural schools and urban schools, all types of high needs and underfunded districts, do not get the same amount of money under the formula that determines the gap elimination adjustment. Most of the money in the last couple budgets was already used to restore the GEA in high needs districts. So what's left over in the GEA is mostly in places like Pittsford and Brighton, which are well-funded, high-achieving districts, which certainly deserve their fair share of funding. But the schools that are really struggling and need the money are not addressed in the gap elimination adjustment formula.
Okay, let me get to some of your phone calls, and we'll start with Cindy in Rochester. Go ahead, Cindy.
Hi. I just wanted to make a brief comment about the minimum wage.
Okay.
I know that I worked at a very small business. The owner worked with us, and there was maybe 5 employees. If she hired a new person at minimum wage at $15 an hour, then the rest of us would all be making roughly the same amount of money. So in order to maintain us, she would have to raise the rest of our wages in order to value the people that were there already and had experience and had the knowledge that helped keep her company running.
Cindy, stay on the line. I want Eamon to respond to that because I know you hear this a good amount, this kind of the dichotomy between the minimum wage impact on small businesses and, say, a corporation. So how would you respond to Cindy's comments?
you know, everybody deserves a living wage. So it's kind of a strange argument to say, well, we're going to have to pay people what they need to survive. And that's a real problem for my business. It's like, well, what about those individuals living on poverty wages? And it's a myth that somehow we don't pay for that as taxpayers through the many different assistance programs that we have in this state. We need to make sure that if you're working 50 hours a week, you can afford to survive. A lot of people work multiple jobs at these, you know, $9 hour wages that is not going to cut it. And a $15 an hour wage is what can make a person's life viable in a city like Rochester. So why shouldn't we pay that? I think we need to put the burden back on the employers that if you're going to run a business and a successful business, it shouldn't be subsidized by wages that are inadequate.
Cindy, what do you think?
I think that still doesn't solve the problem of the existing employees who've worked there for years, and now a new guy who doesn't know anything about the business, he comes in at the same wage as the top person in the company. I mean, I know that obviously $15 an hour is a decent wage, and I'm not arguing that. It's just how then would she be able to structure the whole wage scale in order to say, okay, the guy who's been here the longest, he's making X amount of percentage more than the new guy. I mean, it would make more of a an effect on the budget of that company more than just hiring a guy at $15 an hour, but now structuring the rest of us.
Cindy, thanks for the phone call. Eamon, go ahead.
Yeah, and I think that what Cindy actually brings up is a really good point, is that what we have seen is with such a low minimum wage for so long, that has suppressed everybody else's wages. So for a lot of young professionals who make around $15 an hour, they should be making more. And I think raising the minimum wage should put that positive pressure on wages that we have not seen through this entire recovery from the Great Recession. Wage growth has not been what it should be. And starting to bring up the bottom should bring us all up.
Okay, let's do this. Let's get a very short break in, and we're going to come back, bring in the owner of an auto parts and supply shop, a small business owner who falls on, I would say, a different side than Eamon on the minimum wage. We're going to take more of your phone calls. I know others want to weigh in as well. And we'll talk more about education funding, minimum wage, paid family leave, whatever you want to discuss when it comes to the budget that is coming down today on Connections next. Coming up in our second hour, my colleague from downstairs joins me in studio, host of Open Tunings on WRUR, Scott Regan, in studio on Connections, because his artwork will be featured all month long at the Little Theater's Gallery Cafe. It's part of Art and Music 3. We'll talk to musicians who are artists and artists who are musicians next hour on Connections.
This is WXXI AM Rochester, WRUR FM and HD Rochester, WEOS FM and HD Geneva, and WXXI FM HD2 Rochester.
Texas singer Maren Morris came into her own as a songwriter in Nashville.
At the time, I didn't consider myself an artist, but with that song, it all changed. Can I get a
Now her next album is one of country's most anticipated debuts. Hear why later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on your NPR News station.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I see the phone ringing. We'll get to many more of your phone calls this hour with the New York budget coming down here. And my guest in studio is Eamon Scanlon, lead education organizer with Metro Justice and the Alliance for Quality Education. You just heard his comments to a listener named Cindy on minimum wage. And it's important to point out, Cindy called in and was talking about a potential $15 minimum wage. We don't have to speak in hypotheticals anymore. The budget, even though the Assembly hasn't finalized it, it's essentially done. The Senate passed their version. The Assembly's about to do that this afternoon. And what we know about the minimum wage schedule is this. A $15 minimum wage is going to happen for New York City, Long Island, and Westchester counties starting in 3 years, 2019. Upstate New York, which is everything else, will get a $12.50 minimum wage starting in 2021. So $12.50 upstate, And again, we've been saying if you factor in today's dollars, closer to $11 an hour. But that's going to be upstate. And I want to bring in Tim Sheafin, who is a small business owner, owner of an auto parts and supply shop in Bloomfield, who was on the program just a little while ago. And I asked him to come back in and share his thoughts on where the budget deal finished up. So, Tim, I know you were concerned about $15 an hour. They decided on $12.50 starting in 2021. What do you think?
Well, it's not as scary as the $15 an hour figure, but I'm afraid what I anticipate happening is we're going to see a considerable amount of inflation go up due to that increase in the cost of our labor. And then some of the other effects that some of the other people have already commented on are certainly going to come to play. Those that are at a rate that is close to that potential new minimum wage, you know, they're not going to feel comfortable that the guy starting is going to now start at a rate so close to theirs. So, yes, we will have to step up the rate for our other employees because maybe people have heard this before. This minimum wage is an indicator that everybody, industry, business people, merchants, the entire economy uses that as a baseline. Now, I agree that these people at that category deserve better. I agree that if we get more money in the pockets of these particular people in this category of class, we're going to see a stimulation. However, there has to be another solution that doesn't wreak havoc across the board.
Tim, tell us about the size of your company and some of the history and what it is you do exactly.
Well, I own an automotive repair center. We do sell auto parts. We are actually celebrating 16 years in business today at this location here in West Bloomfield, New York. I have two full-time technicians that are skilled people. These are people that have taken the effort, the time to learn a trade and a skill, and they do it very well. Now, clearly, they make above minimum wage. But then there are times where I do have minimum wage employees. I have high school kids. I have entry-level people. I have retired people that are on pensions and Social Security that are looking to do a little extra. I've got a lady that files for me. So, you know, it's not just those entry-level people and those part-time people that are going to be affected. It's these two skilled people that have taken that time to climb higher than that level that are going to, you know, be, you know, unhappy when these wages start to come into play. And I won't let that happen. I need these people. My business is built around their skills. My labor rate is built around their cost. So unfortunately, it's going to drive my labor rate right up. And the reason for that is, as I said, I've been in business for 16 years. I have redefined my business over and over again. I have found every possible way that I can cut costs, buy products cheaper, you know, do volume purchasing so we can get the cost of our parts lower. But with labor, these options are no longer existent.
Tim, again, how many employees do you have total?
I have two part-time, two full-time currently.
Okay. So, Eamon, you hear Tim talking about this concern that someone at a minimum wage of $12.50 instead of where it currently is may be making close to some people who've been, you know, full-time employees establishing themselves there, and that could be an issue. It's similar to what Cindy was saying. What do you make of that?
We have to remember that when we hear $12.50, that's still 5 years away, and still subject to who knows if the Republicans take over in a couple years, if they slow down that schedule. I mean, there's a lot of unknowns. And with inflation, it's really more of a nominal raise than what $12.50 sounds in today's dollars. 5 years is a long, long ways away. So I think the idea that it's going to wreak havoc is a bit alarmist. And I think that there is enough pent-up demand for labor and whatnot that I don't think we're going to see, you know, a lot of unemployment. I don't think we're going to see a lot of havoc. And the idea of a minimum wage is that everybody's got to compete on the same level. So for every small business, they're going to have the same increases in labor costs. And I think that, you know, the best businesses will survive and continue to do good work. But if a business only can survive by underpaying its workers, then that's not a sound business model to begin with.
But do you think Tim is underpaying his workers?
I think everybody is underpaying their workers. I would not single out Tim. I would say that nobody can survive on $9 an hour, and I challenge any small business owner to do that.
Okay, Tim?
Well, I certainly respect what he said. I agree with a large majority of it, but we're looking at this the wrong way. The minimum wage is not a number out there where we have to say, okay, you graduated high school, now go out and survive on minimum wage. That's not it. The minimum wage is the bottom rung of a ladder, and the person needs to find a way to climb to the top of that ladder. Now, if that means I work at minimum wage for 6 months while I'm putting myself through night school, I'm going to make that next ladder rung. If that means I work for minimum wage for a year or two till I save up enough money to help underwrite the cost of my education, and now that I'm educated, I'm at the third, fourth, or fifth ladder rung, then that's what I need to do. A previous show and a previous caller said we should work on workforce development. Now, that's a generic term, but I would like to say that it starts at home. You know, what makes a person desire more? What makes a person want more? What makes a person achieve more? Well, hungry makes me want to eat. Poor makes me want to do better. You know, I saved and saved and saved and saved and saved until I had enough money where I felt confident that I could try to go out and do my own business. I worked for companies for years, and here I am now. But that started with me. It wasn't a soup line where I had my hand out. It wasn't an area where I felt that I couldn't go any further. I have instilled in myself somehow, or my parents did, a desire to do more.
Eamon?
There are a lot of people still suffering under the effects of racism and policies that were geared to keep people poor in this city. And it's not so easy, the kind of pull yourself up by your bootstraps narrative that is often put out there. The economic realities for hundreds of thousands of people in Monroe County is quite dire. And to ignore that and to sell a dream that has not worked for decades, I think is not a real term.
But he's saying it worked for him.
Yeah, and that's the fallacy that we want to promote is like, look what I did. All of you can do this. You're not suffering severe effects of poverty and a lack of education and a lack of opportunity. You know, it's wonderful for the individuals that are able to overcome certain things, though I can't speak to his specific story. But, you know, what about the 15,000 students in the Rochester City School District that will not finish with a degree that are currently in there in that system right now? You know, we know the graduation rate's about half there. So these people need something to live for. And if the bottom rung of the economic ladder is not a livable one, what are we condemning all those people to?
All right, Tim, I'll let you respond to that, and then I'll take some more phone calls as well. Go ahead, Tim.
Well, if anybody that's listening has lived in the Rochester region for more than 5 years, I think they can develop their own opinion on what's happened with the Rochester City School District. If I were in charge, if a logical, sensible, compassionate business person like those that were on the show a few days ago that were talking about ethics, if there was someone in charge like that, not the let's pay them a lot of money, you're here for 6 months, let's pay a 6 month severance pay, let's get somebody new. If we could seriously implement the type of education, the type of empowerment, the type of stimulation that is provided to people like myself, that's going to solve it. I didn't have parents that had lots of money. My father would not give me one dime ever, but he did give me advice. He gave me encouragement. He gave me opportunity. And that's out there. If you can't find it, if you can't get it, and you're not willing to take advantage of programs that have been put out there for it, let's identify the problem. What is the problem? And that's where the effort needs to be placed, is programs, training, mentoring. We need something to get in the brains of these people other than what's in there now that's limiting their ability to achieve.
All right, let me grab Bonnie in Rochester, who's been waiting to come in. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yeah, there's a lot to say after that conversation. The minimum wage issue to begin with. Any time you have kind of a dual, in this case, minimum wage structure, you know, I think if you look historically, it creates a lot of problems. Some of which have been named already. There's a whole bunch of others that just don't work well. From the individual to individual, from one system to the other, it's, you know, it's not a good model. Along that same line with the minimum wage is that, you know, there was a big kind of back and forth about the minimum wage as it would affect workers in service agencies, like, you know, direct care people working in services for people with disabilities and home health aides. So I'm assuming that this new, you know, the final version includes them, because, well, here's an irony. A lot years ago, when the state was deinstitutionalizing, and there was a kind of a back and forth between continuing public services and privatizing services, over the years, the state has used not-for-profits and others to provide some of those direct care services. And one of the reasons they did this, and this is no, there's no question that this was one of the main reasons, is because those folks in these other systems were not unionized and they got lower wages. So just think for a minute. Now those folks are possibly at risk, and the agencies that they hire them have, you know, were pleading, saying if you raise these wages, that's going to make it impossible for them to do their business. And so here we have a really good example of kind of like tail wagging the dog and paying for your mistakes when you make a pattern of changing people's jobs so that you can, and it wasn't the only reason, but it was one of the main reasons, is lower wages, and then you get caught by the fact that the people who are getting these wages along with others can't make a decent living for themselves, and that's going to affect also the quality of care of people. When you have, the potential could be now that you would have workers in these human service agencies that are going to earn lower wages than somebody working in a restaurant. And that's not to say that person in the restaurant doesn't deserve. We are talking now about a wage system where the minimum wage needs to be raised so much because that has become low wage now.
Bonnie, we lost audio on your call, but you gave us a lot. You gave us a lot there, and I want to let, first of all, Tim Schieffen respond. Tim's a small business owner in Bloomfield, so you heard a lot there. Tim, go ahead.
Well, I think I have her point, but I think sometimes people don't really take a step back and look at that big picture. You mean to tell me that a high school kid, fresh out of high school with no training, is now going to walk into a job at $12.50 an hour? Is that fair to the working mother with one child that's been stuck at the $10 mark for 6 years because she doesn't have the ability to find a way to better herself? I don't think that's the solution here. I think the solution here is to start earlier, and this is going to take time, start earlier. You know, when I went to high school, we had home economics. Home economics teacher came out and said, if any of you people think you're going to survive on the $3.75 minimum wage, you're crazy. And that's what it was when I was in high school. Well, somehow I was able to save enough money to pay for my college education. I took out student loans. I saved money from working for two summers. And I had enough money to pay to put myself through tech school. So, you know, what's the difference? Is it the color of my skin? Is it the desire in my heart? You know, I raised my children to see one color, and I don't care what color it is, they were our friends. Society explained to them what different colors were. You know, we need to get beyond that racial labeling, the color of a person's skin. That's irrelevant in the business world. I don't look at the color of a person's skin when I anticipate their cost, their position in my machine, and how things are going to work out. I look at their skills. I look at their performance. What they have at home is none of my business. I put a job offer out. There's a rate attached to it. If they meet my expectations, they continue to work. And over the course of time, I give out a periodic raise to an employee that merits a raise. And I think there's many others out there that would offer the same.
All right. Well, Tim, I think Eamon wants to respond, and then I've got to get back to the phone calls, which are flooded. This has turned into just a minimum wage discussion. We're talking about the budget and all the different things related to it. But I understand. And Tim, I think Eamon has absolutely the best intention at heart there, what he's describing. But it looks like you disagree. Go ahead.
It's wonderful to hear that he does not see color, but color still is an issue in terms of the policies that we have, and I think the state budget reflects that. And you know, I'm going to bring it a little bit back to education because, again, we have money going to districts that aren't in the highest need, and we keep leaving behind so many of the same communities, which are predominantly people of color, you know, African American and Latino families and other immigrant communities here in Rochester and throughout New York State. And they're continually left behind by the policies of this state. So it's not like we're in some post-racial utopia. There are still very real legacies of decades and centuries of oppression, and there are still laws in effect now that make it very different for young people of color trying to do the sort of pull yourself up by your bootstraps fallacy that is constantly pushed on the right to justify policies that keep those people down and disempower them. When you have a $15 an hour wage, you can finally start to build a family and a real life and have agency over what you do in society. But when you are constantly playing the poverty game of scrimping together what you can to survive, you're never going to see the real lasting change that would empower these communities more broadly in New York State.
All right, let me do this. Tim Schiefenstein, the line with us, small business owner, and calling into the program is Brian Sampson. I want to bring Brian in. Brian is the president of the State Associated Builders and Contractors, who had a hard time getting through just of how loaded we are talking about minimum wage. Brian, we talked on this program a few days ago about your concern about the minimum wage at $15 an hour. Again, yeah. If our listeners just joining us, $12.50 is the number for upstate, but not until 2021. Where does that sit with you, Brian?
Well, we still think it's too high. I mean, when you consider the fact that we have the 50th worst business tax climate in the country, I rattled off a number of statistics where New York is ranked at the highest levels of cost factors. You know, at $12.50, it's still too high. And I understand the arguments about we need to lift people out of poverty, but there's other ways to do it. We talked about workforce investment, finding a new career path for people, helping them along those lines, earned income tax credits, arbitrarily dropping a multi-billion-dollar tax on the residents of upstate, because that's what this will be when services go up, goods and products go up. It's just not the right time to do this, and we still think there's going to be tremendous job loss, especially at the lower end of the ladder where people are using those jobs to build their skills to promote a career.
Brian, we've been hearing from supporters of a higher wage, including Eamon Scanlon, who's in studio, pointing out that $12.50 isn't until 2021, and if you assume sort of a normal rate of inflation, and who knows what happens in the next 5 years, it's closer to $11 an hour. Does that change it?
No, not at all. And I get the arguments, and again, I feel sympathy for the people that are in, you know, the cycle. You know, we talked about it on your show. There is a cycle of poverty, and we need to address that cycle of poverty. But forcing businesses to make decisions, and again, this is a phase-in approach, but it's also on the number of employees. So if you have 10 or fewer employees, you have a phase-in period, where if you have 11 or more, it's a different one. So now you're going to – what are you telling employers? Keep your ranks at 10 and under, because that's, you know, going to be a little bit better for you, and we'll phase this in slower. Why are we forcing people to make those choices? If they have a need to hire, they should hire. And when people get hired, they get experience, and that experience allows them to move into a different career path. We have great fear that's not going to happen that way. And, you know, I think the real losers in this whole process are going to be those that don't have a lot of skill, don't have a lot of education and background, who do want to lift themselves out of poverty, but those jobs simply are not going to be here, Evan.
All right, Brian, as busy as you are, one more question, I'll let you go. Then what are you going to do next? I mean, what are you and your organization going to do next? I mean, you have to live with this structure that's in 2021, a $12.50 wage. You know, what are you going to do to, in your own view, mitigate some of the concerns there?
Well, you know, we have the rest of session to try to get some of the regulatory fixes done in this state, from, you know, workers' comp to different tax laws, different, you know, labor rules that have an impact on what happens. So hopefully we can get some of those things reformed. But at the end of the day, business does have a choice on whether or not they want to live with this. They can automate or they can move. And I think we will see a number of companies automate. Jobs will go away. Companies will move. Companies will choose not to come to New York. And those are things that we're never going to be able to overcome. And, you know, I've said all along, once you raise minimum wage, and what we're talking about, Evan, is a decade. This will be a decade of wage increases for New York employers when this is fully done, from what we just did to what we're now going to do. You can't go backwards once you make those raises. You can't take minimum wage back. And that's going to have a profound impact on what we do going forward.
Brian's the president of the State Associated Builders and Contractors. Thanks for the time, Brian. We'll talk to you again soon.
You got it, Evan. Thank you.
All right, let me get Michelle in Rochester who wants to weigh in on the minimum wage. Go ahead, Michelle.
Hi, Evan. I really like what Brian just said, and I'm not convinced that you can mandate anything, that it's a good idea. I was also a small business owner, and listening to him speak, I understand where he's coming from. The one thing I think is missing from his argument, so to speak, is empathy. And that is, you know, it's easy to look through the prism of one's own experience and apply that to everyone else. I was raised the same way, hardworking, worked a couple jobs, you know, the whole thing, had my own business, successful. I have two children. One is successful and grown and out. The other one has a learning disability, just gray borderline, and probably will never be able to get where we would both like her to get through no fault of her own, and has taken advantage of all the services and job training and everything else. But I really worry about her, and I'm not saying that she should get paid more. All I'm saying is it's dangerous to say that anyone who isn't where you think they should be or where they could be is there as a result of a lack of a desire. It could very well be they don't have the capabilities that you do.
Well, thanks very much for the phone call, Michelle. And, Eamon, you're nodding at some of that there at the end there. Go ahead.
No, I think she brings out a very profound point. There are so many special needs children and adults throughout New York State that deserve a certain amount of dignity and respect. And I think that's very true. I know that about 19% of the Rochester City School District, they have special needs kids, 19%. That's mm-hmm. that's a huge number. So it's not an insignificant part of the population. And I empathize. I really see what she's saying.
All right, Tim, before I let you go here, just some final thoughts from you as a small business owner down in Bloomfield of an auto parts and supply shop. $12.50 an hour in 2021. Does this change your plans and your outlook as a business owner? What do you do next?
My plans will remain the same. My outlook will be unknown. I guess we're going to have to see how it goes. Michelle is absolutely right. I don't think we're talking about the special needs people specifically with this argument. I think there are certainly programs and options that those people may qualify that the average person that's stranded at minimum wage does not. I do have empathy for those people. I feel terrible for some people, but the more I look at it, the more I have to say that it's a matter of time for those people that do receive a higher wage to find out that it's gobbled up by all the effects of that same wage. These people at Albany are not really doing the job they need to. Our educators, especially in the city of Rochester, don't have their eye on the ball. And, you know, when you add all these factors up, there's no surprise why so many are stranded at such a low rate. There needs to be more options available to everyone, and we need to put a greater effort towards these things to solve these problems. I mean, it's not a simple fix. This minimum wage is going to be a short-term fix, and it's not going to be able to be undone. And when the results of it are present, it's going to be too late to get these businesses that have moved away or failed or closed up to come back to life. I won't do it.
Tim, well, congratulations on 16 years. Thanks for taking the time for the program today.
Thank you for allowing me the opportunity.
Tim Schieffen, the owner of Cars Auto Parts and Supplies in Bloomfield. On the subject of community schools, I know Beverly's been waiting, and against my better judgment, we're down to about 2 minutes left. Go ahead, Beverly.
Hi, I'm calling because I want to draw attention to the receivership in the school system here in Rochester. You know, it's amazing how much that the Senate and the Education Committee of the Senate can sit up there and make demands of these schools and expect them to change overnight when they're not funding these schools properly. My school is School 44 here in Rochester, and I tell you, One minute they give us rules to do this, another minute they give us rules to do that. You're in receivership, you're not in receivership. When all we want is for Albany to release the monies that they owe the school so we can make the improvements we need.
All right, Beverly, only because we're running out of time, I got to let you go. But Amy, why don't you respond to some of what you just heard, about 40 seconds.
Yeah, I think Beverly is 100% correct. You know, we need to stop punishing schools that need extra help. If we fully funded them under the Campaign for Fiscal Equity and we responsibly phase in with real parent engagement the community schools money that was set aside for schools like 44, we can see genuine improvements in academics and in the community at large.
And how is that going to change, Eamon?
More specific?
Well, I mean, it's been 10 years since this court ruling, as Karen DeWitt reported. Right?
Yeah, it was starting to be phased in right before the Great Recession hit, but we're at a phase now where it's time that there's no more excuses and there's no more GEA, so let's fulfill the CFE.
All right, well, that is, I would say, on the education side, for groups like Eamon's, Metro Justice and others, some of the biggest disappointment. But you also heard some of the other aspects of the budget and debating some of the impact. Not a $15 minimum wage upstate, but a $12.50 minimum wage upstate. So California, $15 statewide. New York State, $15 in New York City. Long Island and Westchester by 2019. $12.50 by 2021, unless things get really wild this afternoon and something changes. But we certainly appreciate all the calls and interest on all sides of this. And my guest in studio, I want to thank Eamon Scanlon from Metro Justice and the Alliance for Quality Education. Thanks for the time.
Thank you, Evan.
And our thanks to Karen DeWitt for joining us as well. More Connections next.